He's living in a different universe.
Systems. And we'll open public. Well, actually, we'll open work session because they're scheduled for work session. Open a work session on House Bill 2003, House Bill 2008, House Bill 2020. I don't know that we have amendments quite ready on any of those bills today, but I did want to open the work sessions just to take any testimony that we have. I know the PERS agency has some testimony regarding the statewide experience with deferred comp and defined contribution as it relates to the Oregon Savings Plan. So we'll call them to come up. It's about a 18-slide presentation, so looking forward to it.
I hope that wasn't his shot.
No, not at all. Jim, I would never make fun of you in any way. You've been so helpful.
Chair Canope, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jim Voitko from the Public Employees Retirement System, and I'm accompanied by Christina Shearer, our Director of Financial Analysis. And the committee asked that we present a little bit of information on the state's experience with defined contribution plans, because we've spent so much time delivering information on the existing and much larger PERS plan that we are happy to do this. Oregon has more experience with a defined contribution structure than many folks think. This is true of both of employers and of public employees, and perhaps there's some lessons from that experience that we can draw from this information that you might find useful. But I would say that if that is the case, I suspect you will find them equally applicable to either a straight DC successor plan or a DB-DC hybrid plan that contains a DC component. I don't think that if there's any value in this presentation, I think it will come, it will be equally applicable to both types of plan structures. The Oregon Savings Growth Plan, in summary, we and PERS assumed responsibility for this plan in 1996, even though it was begun back in the 1980s. We completely restructured it, and since that time it has grown extremely rapidly. It's a defined contribution-based plan. Its aim is to protect deferred compensation until retirement. The OSGP, as a defined contribution plan, offers to public employees of those participating employers, and that's key because the employers have to agree to participate. Once they do, their employees become eligible. They voluntarily opt in, and they receive the opportunity to invest in one or any of the above nine investment options, each with varying levels of risk. These options are drawn exclusively from the private sector, money management community. Each individual private sector investment manager is selected in an open competition by the Oregon Investment Council and continuously monitored by the Treasury staff under OIC direction. The OSGP client service and record keeping, the administrative part of it, is not done directly by PERS, but rather is done by a competitively chosen private sector third-party administrator that we choose in an open competition, and then we monitor their performance. So we only have a handful of people that actually operate this DC plan from a FTE point of view. We rely extremely heavily, 95% plus of the activity of this plan is outsourced. The governance and oversight is the only part that's retained by the state. What we have found since 1996, when we first took over this program, is very rapid growth. This chart indicates on the left-hand side the number of participants in state government, that is state employees, who have voluntarily joined the plan and begun to place income into the plan. And as you can see, it's very steady growth. And one of the things I'd comment on is that the participation has increased even since 2000, when the markets have turned south. One might expect that people might have decided to leave the program, but that doesn't appear to be the case. We've still seen people joining the program, albeit at a slightly slower rate. On the right-hand side, what you see is what percentage of state employees are actually opting to put deferred income above and beyond PERS into the OSGP. And what we find is 44% of all eligible state employees, which I believe is all of them, are actually participating and deferring income under this structure for retirement. The same data is shown on the next page, and you can see that for the plan as a whole, including both the state and local, about 36% of all employees who could participate do participate. And on the right-hand side, you can see the OSPS stands for the state payroll system, and 44% of those paid through the state payroll system, which is the vast majority of all state employees, have voluntarily opted to join this deferred compensation program. You know, as a manager as well, I would not argue here before you that salaries are excessive, but one of the lessons that I draw from this is that state employees, at least, and it looks like public employees generally, are going out of their way to save additional income for retirement above and beyond PERS. And we'll see a little bit later that, in fact, they save more than the average 401k participant. This does not include this participation in both PERS and OSGP plus Social Security. It does not include any participation also in IRAs, for example, at the federal level, or participation in 401ks that they might have in private employers that they've worked at either pre or post their public employment. One of the things that's interesting to note, too, is that while we would expect our older public employees to participate more in OSGP simply because we have more older public employees, this is probably a little more than we would expect. So our demographics mean that this is a program that's particularly popular for people over 40 or 45 in the public sector. I think that there's little doubt that it's probably participation is probably encouraged by the notion that retirement is getting closer once you get to that age. I can speak from experience on that point. This chart is very interesting, I think, because there's several points I want to make here. First of all, the amount of money that OSGP participants, and that now we're talking about public employees who participate in this program, put aside, is pretty substantial. The footnote at the bottom indicates that the average monthly contribution into this DC structure is about $335 a month, or approximately $4,000 a year. The Profit Sharing Council of America estimates that in 2001, the average private sector 401k monthly contribution was just a little under that, at about $3,800. The lesson I draw from this is that public employees in, at least in Oregon, and at least those who participate in the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, appear to have a stronger desire to save than the average 401k participant. And this is despite the fact that we have a basic PERS retirement program that comes in underneath this that is not voluntary, that they cannot opt out of. One of the things I wanted to mention is that the way the program has been restructured, I think, is very, very sensible from an investment policy point of view, in the sense that we give employees many options, 9, but the options are offered on the basis of risk and reward rather than brand manager X versus brand manager Y. And this is very important because no financial planner will tell you that risk and reward and their matching against the individual's own preferences isn't the single most important thing that they can do other than save in the first place. And so what we've tried to do is to focus employee decisions on how much risk they want to either take or avoid. And the next couple of slides give you some information about how our, under this DC structure in the state, how our public employees have reacted to it. First thing I'd note is that 4 out of every 5 participants in this program have chosen to adopt at least 2, if not as many as 5, of the options that have been offered. What that means is that the vast majority, over 80%, have spread their diversification widely among these options, which is exactly what a financial planner would like to see. We find it interesting because even within every one of these options, the OIC has constructed an investment policy that offers a minimum level of both manager and investment diversification that the employee can't opt away from. When you combine two, three, four, or five options, what you get is a very substantial degree of diversification. The other thing I'd point out is in the far left-hand side are those 19% of employees who have chosen to put all their eggs in one option, something that would normally you'd say, well, is that a good idea? Well, first of all, any of the options that have more than the average amount of risk have, again, this multiple diversification that the selector, the decision maker, in this case the public employee, cannot avoid. But the other thing I'd point out is that about half of the people that choose a single option choose the most conservative option or the next most conservative option. So that what we're seeing here is not risk-seeking, but we're as much or more seeking extreme risk aversion. And I think I testified to that last week, that it is one of the reasons why 401k and other defined contribution assets sometimes lag behind those of pooled funds that are professionally managed, because some members believe that they prefer lower rate of return and much more conservative investment structure. The next slide indicates the same thing, in that what we're showing here is that substantial numbers of plan assets have been placed by the employees themselves in what are called conservative or very conservative structures. Stable and money market funds, these are stable investment return funds, intermediate term bond funds, cash accounts, that would be a money market account. Account for is almost half of all assets in the fund. So this is again, I think that public employees through their choices are signaling their desire to both accept diversification and in fact seek it, and within that diversification actually lean toward more conservative options. The other thing I wanted to note, which is on page 10, is the degree to which the OIC, working with the Treasury staff and with PERS, have tried to structure an extremely low-cost set of investment options that have multiple options that are easy to understand and yet do not layer in any overhead fees of what I would call assemblers, overhead managers, fund-to-fund managers, or other fund intermediaries. So when you look at the options that are currently being offered in the plan, one, there are many. Two, they rely on 15 different private sector money managers, institutions. They have, among those 15, have been selected 28 different investment products, and we have none of the financial intermediaries that stand between our members and their investment choices and the actual entity that's going to manage their money. And what this does is this cuts out a whole level of fees that in previous incarnations of this and other programs that I've looked at have led to high costs. So I think that over time the state has taken its DC plan and moved to a structure that is very low cost and prevents that has no intermediaries between the member and the individual managing their money other than the fiduciary oversight of the OIC. Now, I focused a lot on what's happening with respect to state participation and state public employers. On page 11, I wanted to make the point that the OSGP is spreading beyond the state and into the universe of local public employers. And that includes all types of local public employers, school districts, counties, cities, special districts, and so on. In fact, if you look at page 12, you can see that over since 1998, when we first began signing up for local employers beyond the state, the acceptance of the program has gone up very, very rapidly. In fact, I'm very proud and had my staff appear before the PERS board at its last meeting, because we just recently added our 100th local public employer to the Oregon Savings Growth Plan, and we have a number more in the pipeline. So I also believe from talking to the staff that to the extent that with the legislative action underway, to the extent that the controversy or uncertainty over the basic PERS program can be ameliorated in some way, it has been a drag on signing up employers for the OSGP structure as well. And I think that we'll probably see an acceleration of local employers join this plan. Again, on page 13, since we have only begun signing up local employers in approximately 1998. Following the process of signing up an employer, then you go out and find out who among their employees really wants to then join. So the employer first says, yes, I'll offer the program. Then the employee says, I'll join or not join. And what you can see on the right-hand side is that as employers, local employers have signed up, shortly thereafter, local employers, local employees have decided to agree to participate voluntarily, and that growth has been extremely rapid over the last several years, despite the fact, again, that the market has been very poor, and that is reflected directly, of course, in the statements of any DC plan. Page 14 gives you a sense of what I said earlier, that the number of or the variety of types of local public employers in our state that have decided to voluntarily participate and sign up with the OSGP program is very significant. It really covers all the bases, but this data and our anecdotal evidence appears to indicate that the OSGP has proved especially attractive to smaller local employers. And I think there are some fairly obvious reasons why that might be the case. One is there's little record-keeping burden. This is a simple payroll deduction for the most part. There's no program cost to the employer. The plan funds itself out of its own asset values. There's no potential UAL. And the OIC takes on the responsibility for continuously monitoring and adjusting the slate of investment advisors, and so relieves small entities of having to worry about whether or not somebody is looking after the folks managing their public employees' money. If you turn to 15, you get a sense for local governments about how fast the growth has been. Obviously, these dollars, which are the annual number of dollars that local government public employees are putting in the plan, these are small numbers by comparison to the large behemoth PERS plan. But what is interesting to note is that the rate of deferrals by public employees, again, all on a voluntary basis, is going up almost exponentially. It's been a very rapid growth. I'm wondering how long we can sustain quite that steepness in the growth rate. So if I could conclude on page 16, public employees have a growing asset, not nearly as large or as big a financial stake as public employees as a whole have in the PERS plan itself, but they have a growing asset in the OSGP accounts. These accounts are theirs and in their name. The total aggregate amount of the assets in those accounts, employee accounts, is $540 million. And a number that jumped out at me is the average participating public employee's account in this plan, above and beyond their participation in PERS, is $28,000. And our back-of-the-envelope projections indicate that this plan should be at or around $1 billion by about the year 2009 if we continue to sign up employers, increase contributions, and have some reasonable investment returns over that period. Page 17 reports some data that just came in a few months ago, November of 2002. Where we did a survey of 900 public employees who participate in this program, and quite frankly, I was shocked at how pleased they were with the service that is provided by a combination of PERS, the OIC, our private sector third-party administrator, as well as the money managers. This one in particular focused on these particular facets of the program, but I think you can see that with satisfaction ratings between 88% and 99%, this is a program in which I get very few complaints from public employees. Finally, the last page, because I know you're pressed for time. In summary, the OSGP, if there are lessons for us from the state's experience in D.C. thus far, is that a research-based set of investment choices is a wise idea. Nine investment classes that are focused on risk and risk tolerance rather than on the brand names of the particular providers involved really simplifies this investment decision-making by employees, even those that don't have a lot of experience in making investment decisions, and it leads to higher participation rates. And if you believe the program is a good thing, then higher participation rates is a sign that you're on the right track. We have a clearly defined investment policy determined by the OIC, and I would stress that all of these decisions are made in public meetings under the Sunshine Act, so that everybody sees why an investment policy is adopted or an investment manager is added or subtracted from the slate. The third-party record keeper, in this case City Street, is given a multi-year contract, but that contract is up for rebid each time the contract comes up, and we have a vigorous bidding process for our business. In fact, that contract is up at the end of the year, and we're beginning to gear up for a competitive bid process. And what it has done is made the third-party record keeper very, very attentive to our needs and to the needs of our members. And finally is that what we've tried to strike in this program is an efficient balance between state oversight and of the investment process to preserve oversight, if you will, and attention to the assets of our public employees, but at the same time garner the economies of scale that are provided by private sector vendors, either in record keeping or in investment management. And the program is, we've tried to keep it very simple. We have few policy decisions. We have only a handful of rules that are in place, and that's really the story of what our experience has been, particularly since 1996 to now, in our defined contribution-based system that we run. So I hope that information was of some use, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Yeah, Jim, I was surprised really to learn that 44% of state employees are already using a defined contribution system. I mean, that's incredibly high. Is that high based on a national average?
Chair Canope, members of the committee, I wasn't able to get participation rates. Participation rates are difficult because sometimes the longer the plan has been in place in a particular employer, the higher the participation rate is going to be. So our participation rate at local employers, where we really didn't launch the plan until well after it was launched at the state level, are lower. And that's why our overall plan participation rate is 36%, but the state's is 44%. But 44% is a pretty good participation rate, but I know that from sitting on a 401k, which is a very similar structure committee in a large Fortune 500 company, that our goals for participation were much higher than 44%. So since 1998, the participation, as you see, has climbed, and I think that if the program proves valuable to public employees, they'll sign up. If it doesn't look like it's valuable to them, they won't.
Jim, what are the limits under this plan that an employee can put in above and beyond what they're already doing for, well, for PERS, even though they're not putting in for PERS, most of them?
Chair Canope, members of the committee, there was a recent federal law called EGTRA, and I'm hard-pressed to remember what the acronym stands for. Perhaps Representative McPherson, I'm sure, knows it. But what it did was it expanded the limits, and I believe they're up as high as $15,000 per participant in terms of the amount of money that they can shelter. And all of this is done pre-tax under this program, which makes it very attractive. And So it's a substantial amount of money, and that kind of money is a very substantial portion of the average public employee's salary compensation in the state of Oregon. The other thing that it did was that it conformed very closely to it combined and conformed the 457 structure, which is what we're dealing with here, with 401k, which is its clone in the private sector, so that they look very, very similar. And in fact, most material respects, I believe that they're identical. The other thing that happened in EGTRA is that public employees who participate in these kinds of plans were offered certain catch-up provisions, so that there are extra deferrals that they can make on top of the normal deferrals if they meet a certain age requirement. I believe it's 50 years old. I know this from experience because I happen to be 50, and I welcome the catch-up provisions. So I hope that was responsive to your question.
Yes, thank you. Also, do you have any data on whether it's managers who are using this particular vehicle, or if other workers from, you know, service employees or school district employees, you know, beyond teachers? Do you have any breakdown on those types of numbers?
Chair Canote, members of the committee, I don't, and the reason is that PERS does not ask for the occupation of any participant, either in the basic PERS program or in the OSGP. So the only thing that we know in the basic program, as you may recall, is whether or not they're PNF or general service. In this program, all we know is that they're a member. But I would say that if we have 44% participation rates in the state, most of the analysis that I've seen indicates administrative or managers hover in various agencies something around the 9-13% range. So it would seem that if that's an accurate assumption, then probably it would imply that manager participation, even if every manager participated, they're outweighed 3-1 by regular staff members participating in OSGP. But that's, I'm backing into that conclusion. But with 44%, it can't be all managers.
Right. But since it's a set amount at $15,000 is the cap, you wouldn't know a salary range of the people who are investing necessarily?
I don't think we would know the salary range because, again, the simplicity of the system is we only get a contribution, and it's the employer's obligation to make sure that the contribution is not above the limit. But people don't have to put $15,000 in. They can put any amount from $1 to $15,000 in.
Okay. Questions?
No? I wouldn't want to disappoint you, Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
First of all, Mr. Voitko, it was a good presentation, as always, and it appears to be a well-run program, and I compliment you on both. I want to focus first on your slide 5, which shows the age distribution of participants, and I see that it's a very dramatic slope up depending on what age the employee is. And I wanted you to comment on what that tells us about the income replacement levels that are likely to be achieved under an elective plan based on the age distribution of participants if we were to rely on an elective plan as the basic retirement plan for public employees in Oregon.
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, I interpret that as a two-part question. First of all, does this indicate when these people joined the plan? And this doesn't tell us anything about how long they've been in the plan. It only tells us what their current age is today as a plan member. So, for example, a person who's 54 years old might have been in the plan for 15 years, might have just joined the plan yesterday. So I can't tell for sure. We would expect this simply because, so this doesn't tell us, say anything about the duration of their experience in the plan. We would expect this chart to be of this general nature because we have a very old workforce. If you looked at the demographics of the public employee workforce, this happens to be both the state and the locals, you'd see that we ought to have more 45s, 50-year-olds because we have more 45s and 50-year-olds by far in the workforce than we have 20 and 29-year-olds. So we would expect that to be true of members in a voluntary plan. But the third part of your question, that would be a three-part question, wouldn't it, is a voluntary plan of a DC nature more valuable or less valuable based on when you joined it? And it obviously is more valuable the earlier you put the money in. So duration in a plan like this and the duration of contributions makes the plan more valuable. One can look at that in two ways. One can say, sort of more paternalistically, make those 29-year-olds join this plan because when they get to be 50, they'll thank you for it. The other is that people need to make their own decisions, and maybe it's more important for that 20-year-old to buy a house right now, because they're having kids, and save later. I'm not smart enough to know which I should tell the person to do.
Follow this one? Just to cap that your response to that question, I think you're confirming what's an axiom in retirement savings design, which is that it's the early dollars that are extremely valuable because they compound over time, and that you don't heavy participation late in one's career doesn't replace nearly as much income because it doesn't compound over time. But to move on to another question,
I can't disagree with that.
Okay, very good. Moving on to another question. Based on slide 8, and the general comment you made, it really doesn't depend on, I think, necessarily the graphic presentation, which is that that your observation is that participants, when they make investment choices, are risk-averse. They tend to select a lower-risk basket of investment products or accumulation of products than choices than would a professional manager. What does that mean over the long term about the use of an assumed interest rate in projections? That is, do you think that the 8% projection over the long term that the PERS actuary uses for valuing the benefits under the PERS system is an appropriate rate to use for projecting what will be accumulated under a defined contribution program in which the participants make individual choice?
Chair Cano, Representative McPherson, I've been asked that question by individual legislators and by others working on this, and what I've said, and I believe it, is that I personally would not use the full 8% that we use for a pooled management, perpetually managed pooled fund of assets, such as what we at the OIC manage for the PERS Trust. But I would reduce that by a half a percent. It is somewhat arbitrary. Because of the tendency, and again, it's on average, it's not every employee, but on average, the data, including in our own state, tends to indicate that people move somewhat toward more conservative investments, and that means lower return. But I've also said to those people who have asked me that that might not be a bad thing, because as we've discussed before about plan structures, the strength of DC is its flexibility, its certainty for employers. Its weakness tends to be, whether it's in a hybrid or standalone, is that it provides less certainty for members in terms of retirement income flows. And one of the ways that a member can try to inject more certainty is by choosing somewhat lower return but investments that have less risk of capital loss. And so it's a trade-off between improving some certainty in an inherently less certain structure versus going for higher returns. And that's the way I interpret it. People may differ.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Or to describe what the phenomenon you're circling there in another way, the choice is between, I think, between having individual decision-making by participants, the results of which are because of their natural and, I think, understandable risk aversion, that they get to a lower destination, they have less money at retirement than they would if they don't have to bear that risk, or having a system where the same dollars go in at the front end, but we take the choice away from them and don't make them put them at risk as to the results, in which case they get to a higher destination in terms of the placement at retirement. Is that a fair kind of comparison?
I think there's Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, I want to be clear that if we're talking about a DC plan that's compulsory in terms of its investment, and that compulsory investment policy is based on higher risk, higher return kinds of investment strategies that are more appropriate for pooled, professionally managed investments, that wouldn't be a good idea. And the reason I say that is because you would subject an employee to those higher risk, higher return strategies, not only at age 30, but at age 40, 50, and 60, precisely at the time when their own account, because their economic value is tied up in their account, that would be the least appropriate investment strategy for them. So I'm not sure that would be a very wise strategy. To the extent that you would make compulsory participation in a DB plan that way, you certainly would do what we at the OIC do, is pursue a higher risk, prudent risk, but higher return strategy. But in that case, the risk of any one year, us being above or beyond course, we have somebody to fall back on. It's called the employer. They basically bail us out of the bad years and bear that risk when we have to, and they benefit from the good years. So I want to make clear, because it's an apples and oranges question. In one case, I would not recommend, as a financial advisor anyway, that we compulsorily require members to take on more risk, the risk that's associated with a perpetually managed fund at the age of 60 years old. I hope that was responsive.
It was. But further question, Mr. Chair?
Further question.
To I want to focus on the investment options that are made available. And in slide 10, there's a list here. And I see some names that are familiar names from the mutual fund world and others that are essentially money managers that, in my experience anyway, don't deliver their services through mutual funds. And I wanted to know, is this predominantly a mutual fund-based system, or is it predominantly is there a portfolio that's just for the savings growth plan that's managed by that manager?
Representative Canope, Representative McPherson, I'm glad you asked that. These tend not to be mutual funds because those are loaded with marketing fees and other types of fees that there's no reason our members ought to pay. Because entry to the program is based solely on whether a money manager can produce an investment product that has the right level, competitive level of fees, and fits one of the risk-adjusted options that we want to offer to a member. So it's merit-based. And so what we want from these people is a bare-bones fee structure, not a mutual fund fee structure. And we've been trying to move away in all respects from the additional fees. And so the other entities that you see here are predominantly institutional money managers, for example, that actually do work directly for the pooled management of the larger PERS fund. Let me give you some examples. BGI is a major player, a major vendor in the management of the consolidated PERS trust, as is Oakmark, as is Wellington, for example. And I think that one of the things that we have tried to tell participating employers as well as members is we really believe that the research that we do and the consultants that we hire to manage the $30 billion plus consolidated PERS fund can lead us to the right investment managers to play a role in this as well, and then not have to burden these members with the extra fees of cost or assembly by other middlemen.
Further follow up,
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Are you able to characterize the fee rates are for the management of these pools of assets as compared to what's happening inside the OIC? With the portions of the OIC that are the PERS fund. I'm not sure that terminology is correct.
Representative McPherson and Chair Canova, I believe I could do so, but not off the top of my head, but I can tell you the direction. And the direction is simply this, that we can negotiate very attractive fees for our members with these entities that we give an opportunity, a place on the shelf, for direction by our choice by our members. And however, we can negotiate even greater fee reductions if we offer them $500 million or $1 billion in a single package with a single account and no other record keeping requirement other than just the state of Oregon for the consolidated PERS fund. Very few entities can negotiate at that fees at that level, which sometimes are just a few basis points.
Mr. Chair, I think that last piece of information, which I think what Jim was saying would be available, didn't have off the top of his head, but I think that comparison would be a useful piece of information for us to have. And with your permission, I would ask that he provide us that.
You may ask him directly to provide it to you, and he will. So you don't need my permission to do that.
The data on that compares what as a fee, as a percentage of assets under management, what the difference is between a typical manager in the big pool of the OIC that's for PERS as compared to these providers here.
Be happy to do so, Representative McPherson.
That's all I have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make it abundantly clear, this is kind of a ways and means question, that the OSGP is managed separately and apart. Neither providing resources for nor subtracting resources from the PDRS system. Is that correct, Jim?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, that's exactly true. This is actually a separate program. We do cost allocation to it. It bears all of its own costs. It neither cross-subsidizes nor receives a cross-subsidy from the PERS plan, except to the extent that when we develop knowledge, like knowledge of money managers that and their strengths and weaknesses, we capitalize on that for both programs.
Follow up. So, Jim, where we've got nearly half of the state's employees involved here in the OSGP and other local participants as well, 1,000 or pretty close to 1,000 last count. We've got 9 employees, I think, as I recall previous testimony, less than a dozen employees are involved as compared to nearly 250 requested total number of employees overall. So that this plan, you would say, and I don't mean to lead you, not that you did, Representative, but I don't mean to lead you here, but what's your experience cost-wise in managing one of these kinds of plans as opposed to the PDRS?
Chair Canope, Representative Butler, I can be led. I don't always drink when I get there. There's no question that simpler structures, and I've said this to the PERS task force, are much easier to outsource because one-of-a-kind types of programs that are unique in their structure tend to become a market of one. And the PERS plan, because of its unique structure and complexity, is very close to a market of one, even though we do outsource little pieces of it and certainly the investment part of it. However, straightforward DC plans, as we've talked about in testimony before and you've heard from other people, are ubiquitous now throughout the private sector. And so there are many options. I believe we had at least five different firms compete for the opportunity to do record keeping for the OSGP. And so that is why you're correct. We've been able to manage this program with no extra FTE, or I believe it may be one extra Treasury Department person who focuses on the investment side, on the OIC investment side of it, and just a handful of people here. But I want to stress that for members that we do keep very close eye on both the investment side and the record keeping side, because we do have an obligation to make sure that our outsourced vendors do what they promise to do in service of our members.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any more questions? Thanks, Jim. Very informative. Representative Richardson, did you want to present? While we're waiting for Representative Richardson, I believe you have 8 hours left in which to file your taxes, should anybody out there have not filed yet today. Just kind of a warning for you. Representative Richardson, you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Richardson, representing from District 4, and an advocate for People's Choice and a Fair Retirement Plan. And this is merely to kind of update you on where we stand with the amendments for House Bill 2020. And we've provided to you an updated packet of information. And basically, the initial part of it is just to remind you that what we are trying to accomplish with House Bill 2020 is a defined contribution plan that's patterned after a 401k, which is very familiar to most people, a plan that will be affordable and flexible for providing good benefits for public employees and be reasonable and predictable for the citizens and the employers. It will apply to all new employees of the state as of July 1st, excepting for the legislature and judges. And the key features have been changed a little bit since we talked a week ago. We wanted to consider some of the information that came out in the questions that were brought up during our last presentation. And one of them seemed to be a concern over young employees who might not take the time or have the wisdom to invest anything into their plan. And so originally we had proposed that this would be a dollar-for-dollar match where an employee who chose not to participate would receive no employment retirement contributions, and we've made a change there. What we've decided is that the employers will still end up being available to contribute 6%, but there will be an automatic base of 3% for every employee who's employed for more than 6 months. And so regardless of any employee contribution, every employee would receive a 3% contribution into their base retirement plan. On top of that, for general service employees, there would be a $1 to $2 or 1% to 2% match up to 6%, which means that for an employee who takes advantage of the full match, they will end up contributing 6%, and the employer will also end up contributing 6%, the initial base of 3%, and then the $1 for $2 for the additional 3%. And so for the total match package for general service employees, it would come out at 12%, and then for police and fire, the match is a little bit greater because of the unique circumstances that they work under, and the match total would be 3% again base, and then 1 1/3% being paid by the employer for every 2 1/3% by the employee. And the end result is that with a full match, the employer will put in 7.15% to the employee's 6%. Now the employee can put in as much as he's allowed to under the IRS regulations. Vesting is, it's a 5-year vest. After 60 months of employment, for the employer's contributions, any employee contributions vest immediately. The employee will be able to borrow against his plan to the extent of, I think the present regulations are 50% of the vested portion of the plan. And so if you have an employee who's got a young family, he's been working for 8 or 10 years and wants to buy a house, he'd be able to borrow against his own plan to have the down payment, and then has to contractually pay that money back over a period of time at interest, and so the interest goes to his own plan. Also, if there was an emergency in the family and some unexpected tragedy took place, there is a pool of money that could be borrowed against as allowed by the IRS, the Internal Revenue Code provisions, so that money could be available for important conditions and circumstances, although it must be paid back. Retirement age is flexible, relating to whatever IRS rules would allow. The employee accounts are transferable and liquid. In our society, it's not realistic to think that employees are going to be hired and stay for 30 or 40 years. I mean, employers would like to think that they would be able to keep good employees that long, but we all know that quite often there is a move. And with this defined contribution format, the employee can take with him his vested funds, all that he's contributed, and then all that the employer has contributed after 5 years. And that can go and be rolled over into an IRA or into a new employer's plan. Or if the employee decided to do so, he could even liquidate it, although there are penalties from the IRS to try and dissuade that. So basically, we have contributions that are going in. The longer a person works and contributes, the greater the contributions, the greater the compounding that will take place, and the larger the recovery or the retirement plan that he'll be able to benefit from when he actually decides to retire. We've made another change in our approach to this as far as the administration and the investments. When we were here before, we were talking about having a minimum of 4 private investment groups that would handle the investments, but having discussed this with Mr. Voitko and getting the information that he's just presented to us as far as the success of the Oregon Investment Council and the very low fees that are charged with utilizing the OIC, the determination was made that we would think it'd be wiser to have the OIC use their experience and the contracts that they've negotiated for the Oregon Savings Growth Plan and the PERS Retirement Plan, and use that benefit and that knowledge to help control or to make available the investments pools that would be available for employees under the Fair Retirement Plan. I want to go through a few figures to help point out the potential of this, and since last time we met there was discussion about Social Security, those figures are also included in the packet that I've provided. Before I do that, I'd like to focus on kind of the mix of questions that took place earlier about that dealt with investments and so forth, and remind the committee that when the employee contributes to his own plan, he has the benefit of dollar cost averaging. And when times are difficult, as we currently see in our current economy, there are those who would think, "Oh, we don't want to be in a DC type plan because, what if we didn't have enough money when we retire?" But with dollar cost averaging, we must remember that as we put in contributions every month, we would hope that the stock market would be low while we're putting in those contributions, because we're buying shares at a low level. And then when the market recovers, if you're putting in a certain amount every month, you can buy whatever shares are going to be available in that. And so the lower the market when you're putting in this amount of money, the greater the share purchase that is taking place in your pool. And then when the market recovers, you have the share prices each go up individually, and that benefits a person's plan, which compounds over time. Now, with Mr. Boyko's presentation and the interesting statistic that 44% of state employees are already contributing to a self-directed type plan, we get a clear understanding that employees that work for the government understand the benefit of contributing and saving, and are wise enough to make investments that will benefit their long-term plans. And with that, I would draw your attention to page number 2, which briefly shows Social Security income replacement. There's a lot of confusion about what Social Security will actually pay toward a person who is retiring. And so these figures show what is paid by Social Security for a 65-year-old who is retiring this year, just based on what would be able to be collected now. And it's one of the three legs of the stool for a person's proper financial plan. Retirement is only one aspect. Savings is an aspect, and the OSGA shows an excellent way to save. And then the third is Social Security. And as you'll see that, Social Security is in a sense a defined benefit plan, in that if your final salary was $40,000 and you were 65 and retiring, then you would get 39% of that final salary as a retirement benefit from Social Security, in addition to what you'd saved and what you receive from your retirement plan itself. Going beyond that to page number 3, and I won't go through all these, I'll just use this one as demonstrative. It shows what would be recovered from a person's own retirement plan, what would be earned if they had started at a $30,000 income and earned the assumed rate of 8%, and there was a 6% contribution from the employer and a 6% contribution from the employees for a 12% max. And so with that, and also an assumption that there would be 2.5% pay increases over the years, which is an average, it's a conservative average, you will see that a person who starts at age 25 and then retired at age 62 would have accumulated 130.7% as far as the replacement value over the average of their last 3 years of income. If you added to that Social Security, that 130.7% goes up to 182.2%. And with that, rather than go through all of the figures in a form that's very similar to what you've seen before, are there any questions on where we're at as far as our proposed 2020 amendments?
Questions? Representative Barker?
Thank you. Representative, what about disability? What are we doing about that?
Disability in this plan is similar to what has been proposed in the hybrid defined benefit defined contribution plan, reviewing this as being a separate issue from retirement. There still will need to be disability, but we think that it's best to have that be negotiated and purchased as a separate benefit provided by the employer, and not mix that in with a retirement plan.
So at retirement age, there would be no benefit under this plan. There would be nothing with disability at all.
Except for the best, whatever is vested, the employee would receive.
Okay. And if I may, when you talk about the market up and down and you can buy more when the market's low, as you know, retired, and I have a 457 plan, which is like I joke about it being a 257 plan. I'm retired. Now's the time. I need that. The market is down. There is no money there. I mean, you know, it's lost about half its value. And I've contributed for a number of years. I've been in that for a long time, steady savings. And my fear is that under a strict defined contribution plan, that somebody could have 40 years or more, turn 60, whatever, it's more than 65 now, and all of a sudden, their retirement's gone. I mean, now people who now have planned to retire with their 401ks, you can't because the market's down.
Well, it's true that, Mr. Chair.
I mean, most of them would have been fine, but, you know, if they waited the last few years, they could, and not eligible to retire, except within the last few years, they could find their retirement virtually halved.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, it is true that a defined benefit plan promises a set benefit that you can count on as long as it can be afforded and you don't have a plan that goes bankrupt. In certain circumstances, as we see, there may be even defined benefit plans that will get you 105% or 125% or maybe 200% by the year 2015. But there is an inherent risk with that, of course, because somebody has to pay for that guarantee. And when you have the employer having to guarantee that there's going to be certain benefits, if there is risk inherent with that. In 1999, if we had had this plan in place before that and employees under the PERS plan knew that this was available, there would have been a flood of people going toward the defined contribution plan because of the stock market and the history and how it was going up and up. And so there are inherent risks, but we can learn from experience. And when I was able to present before, I passed out the actual rates of return earned since 1968 from TIA CREF. And if I could just review four of those, if we only looked at a 20-year period, TIA CREF's own experience, actual history experience, for those that invested in 1968 and retired 20 years later, so that would be 1988, there was an 8.3% average return. For those that started in 73 and would have retired in 93, it was 10.3%. For those in 78 and retired in 98, it was 15.8%. For those in 83 and retired December 31st of last year, after 2 years of the dump, theirs was 11.7%. And so there are going to be highs and there's going to be lows, but this is a long-term retirement plan, and the idea is to assure that there is wisdom in the investments, that there is a consistent contribution toward the retirement plan, and that based on history, a defined contribution plan will, in most circumstances, provide a very satisfactory and sometimes extremely generous retirement benefit.
Sometimes not.
Sometimes, absolutely. There may be risk involved with anything. Of course, Enron employees thought that they had a super program as well, but I mean, there are risks in everything, but what we're trying to do is minimize those risks by having a reliable and predictable program that would benefit certainly the majority of retirement plans in the private sector, and certainly we could benefit from their experience in the public sector.
And if I may
follow up?
Thank you. Follow up? Not all the Enron employees went broke. Kenny Boylay did pretty well coming out of that. But I know that's. But I was going to, one other thing about the stock market, they always talk about the stock market always has gone up and they have the numbers to show how long term. But also, is it not true that one of the reasons that always goes up is because they kick the losers out of the bottom? I mean, the S&P 500 isn't the same companies over the years. They have companies that aren't performing, they'll dump them and pick up ones, which would tend to show a more positive view of that curve.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, certainly you want to ride fresh horses, and you don't stay with a lame one, and that's the benefit of having nine different pools that you can choose from, because these advisors do not make their living off of riding dead nags. They don't beat dead horses, they change horses, and so they're making their living with their expertise by constantly reviewing their pool of investments to assure that they're staying with those that have the greatest management, the greatest
cash basis versus plans for the future, and you know, just the whole gambit of investment decisions. And so rather than have employees throwing darts at the Wall Street Journal to pick stocks, it is much wiser to have pools that are managed by investment advisors who know what they're doing.
Thank you.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
Once again, Rich, Dennis, excellent job. You've advanced the debate on what are some important issues here with this further presentation, and I applaud you. I want to make sure I understand the revised contribution formula. It looks like it's 3%, regardless of what the employee does, the employer is going to put in 3%. And then as the employee contributes, then the employer will contribute 50% of that amount, so that it maxes out at 6% from the employee and a 3% match from the employer, plus the regular 3% would be a total of 6 and 6 for general service. Is that
That's
right?
Correct.
Good. Further, Mr. Chair? With respect to the loan provision in the plan, does that mean that any of the dollars that are in the plan could be borrowed against by the employer?
I believe the regulations are that you can borrow up to 50%, but there has to be a promissory note, there has to be a regular payback schedule at a reasonable rate of interest, and the payback has to be completed within 5 years. That's my recollection.
Right. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
But any of the dollars in the plan, whether they're employer or employee dollars, could be borrowed.
I believe it applies to vested money, and so
I'm sorry. Any vested dollars in the plan could be borrowed, whether employer or employee.
You know, I have not reviewed that in recent years. Actually, my understanding would be that it would be whatever account money is in there that is vested. But I could find out from an expert.
Mr. Chair, but it sounds like the intention, I wasn't trying to have make you to guess about what the tax rules are, but rather any dollars that the tax internal revenue code provisions on participant loans from retirement plans, could, anything that those rules would allow to be borrowed, it would be the intention to have them borrowable.
That is correct. We want to make it flexible under the rules.
Okay. Further, Mr. Chair,
follow up.
With respect to the projections of what would be accumulated here in the attachments, the last four attachments, mm-hmm. I noticed that there's a 2.5% annual pay increase assumption, and that caught my eye, and that's there's a relationship to. In the pension world, there's a relationship to pay increase assumptions and rate of return assumptions. There's oftentimes some relationship between those numbers, and 2.5% is maybe where pay increases are currently because we're in a very low inflation environment. But that relationship is quite a widespread, and I think drives some results here. Did you run these numbers with a 4% pay increase assumption, which I believe is what the PERS system uses in their actual evaluations?
No, but I wish I had.
Jim, please, can you shed some light on that, please?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, our actuarial assumption for pay increases, including merits, promotions, and all things that that increase salary, is 4.25%, actually. So these are extremely conservative based on what we assume. And I might also say that this assumption has been questioned, particularly by our local employers, because it is, as you point out, it doesn't seem to be in concert with current circumstances, and it doesn't compare well with, say, recent contract negotiations. But our actuary did a presentation to the PERS board in which he showed, using actual local employers, the effect over the years in various time periods of combining the salary increases in contracts plus promotions and merit improvements, because all of those affect salary and therefore money that's available to be either put in a DC plan or for contributions for a DB plan or in a hybrid. It really doesn't matter. And in fact, somewhat to my surprise, he made a very convincing case that the actual number over an employee's lifespan is more like 4.25%. So this 2.5%. Would be characterized based on the assumptions that we currently use today as quite conservative.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
And I
would direct this question to Jim Voitko. So if in fact, based on the actual experience within the system, pay is going to go up quite a bit faster than 2.5%, then if I'm understanding the numbers correctly, that means that the percentage of pay replacement would be quite a bit lower because the actual pay of the employee late in their career would be quite a bit higher than what's being assumed here. Is that a fair impression?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, I don't think so, because the percentage that is being put into the DC plan is a percentage of that number. So, in fact, the replacement ratios probably wouldn't change, but the absolute income levels generated, the absolute account values generated, would be bigger in nominal terms.
Follow up, if I could.
Follow up.
I think that's right as to each sort of segment of a person's career, but if the pay in the career is rising more rapidly, and those dollars that were put in when a person was paid, say, $30,000 a year rather than $60,000 a year, those were put in, they were a percentage of a $30,000 salary, so that the tendency for you to use an understated pay increase assumption is that we would not achieve these levels of income replacement. Would that be a correct impression?
Chair Canope, Representative McPherson, I think this is something that you know, it's just math and we can work it out. And last week we presented, using our retirement income forecasting model, replacement ratios using the 4.25 for various types of plans, hybrids as well as straight DCs, and we'd be happy to run that. The key thing is that we don't assume that it's a curvilinear function, but rather that it's linear. Is that which one is more accurate? It's hard to say for sure. But we could run these numbers with 4.25, look at the replacement ratios, and answer your question directly rather than try to guess at it.
Right.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, I would appreciate that. And I didn't mean in my question to suggest that I thought it was really a curve. I was assuming it was linear, but that linear at 4.25% is going to take the pay up faster than it's going to take than the dollars are going to get there when some of those dollars are contributed at a lower pay level.
And Chair Canope, if I could follow up, one of the reasons that in our retirement income forecasting model we measure replacement ratios at different times is precisely to try to make sure that people understand that it's not just the day after retirement that the replacement ratio has meaning, but also the day that they become eligible for reduced Social Security benefits, the day that they become eligible for full Social Security benefits, and then very much later in life when, on an inflation-adjusted basis, when the purchasing power of their retirement income has eroded somewhat. So in our model, we typically measure that at multiple points so that decision makers can get a full picture of what the retirement income stream looks like.
I have no more questions, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions? Dennis, I just wanted a couple of questions. I know you don't have your amendments ready, but what do the amendments do in terms of the ORP plan for higher ed and OHSU in your amendments? Are they not dealt with in that plan, or are they rolled in? Or
they are allowed to remain as a separate plan.
So they continue on.
So they also continue separate. I had said judges, legislators. I should have also said the university system.
So judges and legislators aren't in the system.
That's correct. All of them are excluded from this plan.
Okay. Anyone else? Thank you.
Yeah.
Anyone else wishing to testify on House Bill 2003, 2020, or 2008? Nobody else today? Okay. I know we're still working on amendments on House Bill 2003 as well. We're asking a lot of Dave Hendricks right now, and hopefully we'll have tomorrow amendments from Dennis's plan. I think amendments are available for the hybrid plan, and amendments for 2003 we're hoping to have either late this week or Monday or Tuesday of next week, with the thought of potentially moving House Bill 2003 sometime next week. So that's the time frame we're on committee, recognizing that the May 1 date is fast approaching, and we need to move the conversation along. And although we want to be methodical, we want to be aware of that deadline that's looming. So, anything else? We'll close the work sessions on House Bill 2003, House Bill 2008.
House Bill 2020, and we will adjourn committee.